Thank you. May it please the Court. At issue here is the constitutionality of the 10-year statute of repose for medical malpractice actions, specifically as applied to foreign object malpractice cases found in Section 516.105. Section 105 provides for a 2-year statute of limitations in medical negligence cases. There are two statutory exceptions. There are really three statutory exceptions to that 2-year statute of limitations, one for foreign objects, one for the negligent failure to inform of test results, and then there's another exception for minors. There are a couple common law exceptions also to the 2-year statute of limitations, fraudulent concealment exception and the continuing care exception to the 2-year statute of limitations. All of those exceptions toll the 2 years until, in the case of a foreign object exception, the foreign object is discovered or can reasonably be discovered. In this case, Missing Embers Phillips discovered, and only first he had reason to discover, the foreign object in her body 13 years after after the surgeon left it in her body. Unfortunately for her, under Section 516.105, there's a 10-year statute of repose, which would bar her claim. In foreign object cases, unlike other cases that were the cases that were raised in Blasky, the plaintiff must prove duty, breach, causation, and damages. That first element and last element are important here, because unlike in an improvement to property case, which was at issue in Blasky, you have to have that duty. You have to establish that privity up front. It seems to me that for damages, the damage is done. The die is cast once the foreign object is left in the body. In other words, at time zero, the damage is kicked off. You may not have any adverse consequences. You may not have any symptoms from it for 13 years, 9 years, however many years. But you have arguably, if you know about it, have already had the damages. So if a doctor tells you there's a foreign object in your body, you have 2 years from that date to bring your cause of action. If you're not having any symptoms, if you don't necessarily need to undergo a surgery to remove it at that time, that goes to damages. That doesn't go to whether you've met the elements of the case. So while the statute of limitations is told until you discover it, at time zero, unlike in an improvement to property case, you have met all the elements of the case. You just may not know about it.
Is there an obligation everyone has surgery to be careful, to have an MRI every 2 years, or within 2 years of being operated on?
Part of my argument is that is an unduly burdensome precondition, just like those found in Kilmer, just like that found in Cardinal Glennon, where you're requiring the claimant to jump through these hoops. So if you don't.
Is there any insurance company who would pay for that?
That's not on the record.
Well, the 10-year statute of repose, not 2 years. Two is the statute of limitations.
Well, after 10 years.
But you're.
Do you need that? So there's no duty, but should there be? That you, in order to have your claim and your constitutional claim, you need to have an MRI to be sure you don't have anything there?
Yeah. I mean, if you.
Well, how long is too long, though? But what if it's 30 years before you have any ill effects, before you discover it? Can you litigate a claim that's 30 years old?
My position is you should be able to. I mean, going back to that example, are you supposed to mark on your calendar 9.5 years from every surgery or every medical procedure where there may be something left in you? I better go get that full body scan. I better put the insurance company on notice. It's completely unreasonable.
We would have to overturn so many cases where basically you're saying there has to be a discovery rule and there can't be a repose on that. But we don't have a discovery rule in normal tort cases. Damages are sustained and capable of ascertainment. And while often that will be when they're discovered, often it's not. We have rejected arguments saying you have to have discovered it in cases where we found they were capable of ascertainment a long time prior to discovery. But had you were on inquiry notice and you didn't discover it, things like that. and have distinguished them. We just recently reaffirmed a case where a fraud cause of action has a 5-year statute of limitations, and there's but that's told until you discover it, but only for 10 years, and there's a 15-year absolute bar. Right. There's many other circumstances where there's where you may not know about your cause of action before the statute runs, and that's not to say there's not really good policy arguments why you might want to have a discovery rule in such cases for fairness, but this court has said it's up to the legislature to establish those rules, and we have not required application of a discovery rule in every case. Wouldn't the effect of your argument be that all those cases are in question now?
Well, my argument specifically addresses the 10-year repose period.
Yeah, but we worry about the policy implications because you're asking us to decide as a matter of policy that you have to have discovered it or it's unfair. So we can't simply look at these facts. We look at the broad policy concepts.
And to be clear, I'm not arguing fairness. Is this unfair? Sure. But that isn't the argument, and that's not what the court can rest its head on, and it's said that time and time again. It's the unreasonableness. So there are distinctions between these other statute of repose cases. So the statute of repose found in 516.097 for the improvement to land. In Blaski, that was held to be constitutional. It's a 10-year statute of repose. It goes from the date the improvement improvement was completed, or if there's an occupancy permit from the date.
But how is that different as a matter of policy or fairness or for other reasons than here, where if the person didn't know and couldn't know until after that time period?
The difference in that kind of case is you don't have the elements of the case at time zero. So if a grocery store is being built and I'm not the owner of the property, at time zero, if there's an arguably negligent improvement to the land, it doesn't begin at time zero. I don't have privity with the grocery store. In this case, I do have privity and I do have damages. Your damages are kicked off right away. On the improvement to property case, say we're applying it to a personal injury case. Somebody gets injured at the property and it was built 15 years ago. You don't have the elements of the damages, the elements of the cause of action until
Do you have to pinpoint the damages? For example, you have a surgical procedure and sponges are kept in or whatever it would be there. And there really aren't any damages. But then in 5, 6, 7 years, they disintegrate and they do cause damages later. But at the time, are the damages incurred when they're left in, or are the damages occurred when they become toxic?
Well, it occurs to me that the damages and your claim would vest, but the statute would be told right at time zero, right when it's left in. Because, say, under that scenario, you do undergo a full body scan. They say, hey, there's a sponge left in you. Well, it's not causing me any problems right now. But if you want to pursue that, you have to pursue it within 2 years of when you discover.
Are you saying that we should focus more like what Arizona did in interpreting the cruel language to mean looking at the date of injury as opposed to the date of the negligent act?
Well, and there are cases all over the place where we're talking about accrual, whether we're talking about vesting, where we're talking about tolling, and those are all different legal terms.
But we're ignoring the language in the statute. It kind of reminds me of that case that we had, this court had back in, I think it was 98, the Weiss case, where the failure to notify case, which we said, you know, we wish we could have done something, but it was, you know, language in the statute that we couldn't do anything about, and then happily the legislature fixed it.
They fixed it, and it wasn't good for Ms. Weiss, and just like in Laughlin, it wasn't until the legislature fixed it 8 years later. They said this is distasteful, sure, but it is what it is. But I think the legislature showed an intent to give you this cause of action, the general public. You have this cause of action for foreign objects. Under my argument, it begins at time zero. You may have continuing damages and, you know, maybe 10, 12 years later, then it really does start causing you bad symptoms. But at time zero, you have that vested right in that cause of action. That begins when they leave it in. It's different.
And how does that help you as opposed to hurt you? I mean, if there were not for a staff, say the legislature had not written this exception for objects left in the body and had not created the 10-year period and so forth and discovery rule. So it was just under the general medical malpractice statute of limitations. After 2 years, it would be barred. You might well not have had any symptoms and not realized it, although had you known about it, you could have sued because a foreign object was left in your body. And are you saying that is has the same problems? If not,
well, that's the scenario in Laughlin. That it was 12 or 13 years later, and they were arguing for a discovery rule for foreign objects.
But I'm asking about your argument. Would we have to, if you're saying it's unfair because had the statute been opposed because the legislature gave you a discovery rule, but the legislature did not, and we just had our normal statute of limitations that applies to medical malpractice, would you be up here before us? And yet it'd be the same situation. It would be your client not getting to sue about something because they didn't know about it, and except for this artificial limit imposed by the statute of limitations.
If there was not a tolling exception to the statute of limitations, I wouldn't be here today on a foreign object case.
So how is this different?
What we're talking about is for an open courts violation to be violated, you have to prove that they're taking away your vested property right. That wasn't the case in Blaski. The injuries happened more than 10 years after the improvement land. Here, the injuries are kicked off at time zero. So the two-year statute tolls when you can bring the cause of action, but
in every tort case, isn't that the case? That once your damages are sustained and capable of ascertainment, the statute begins to run, and if you don't bring it within 5 years, you're out of luck, even though it was vested at that point.
Well, in the general statute of limitations statute, 516-100, your cause of action can only be commenced after the cause of action have accrued, and they define accrual as not when the wrong is done or the breach, but when the damage is sustained.
But you're saying there can be no statute of limitations in effect because it's vested as soon as it's sustained. Isn't that the intent of your argument?
Well, it's vested as soon as it's sustained, but the general statute goes on and says it continues if you continue to suffer damage. So in this situation, yes, you have damage at time zero. You may not have adverse consequences or need another surgery for 12 years. Your damages are continuing. So you would meet it under the general statute.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have some time on rebuttal. Mr. Stansel.
May it please the court, again, I'm here with Michelle Parrish from my office, and also have Melissa Thayer with SSM in the gallery. Your Honors, as a preliminary matter, we have an issue of preservation of error. The issue of the real and substantial constitutional claim that must be presented to the trial court was not preserved. It was mentioned in the jurisdictional statement, not in the argument. So as a preliminary matter, that issue isn't raised, and the court need look no further. However, for sake of argument, I will go through the analysis of the points on appeal that have been raised. Bottom line, the trial court was right. So was this court before in Ross, Blaski, and other cases. There is no real and substantial constitutional claim here. The reason for that is, in the Ross case, this court said the very statute of repose at issue here, not the Blaski statute, this statute, 36 years old, enacted in 1978, never changed, despite two amendments. That statute of repose, this statute of repose, has been and is uniformly throughout the state applied, equally to all those whose claim is based on foreign objects and equally to those whose claims of medical malpractice are not based on leaving foreign object in the body. So this court's already made that decision. That's the first case, Judge Stiff, that would have to be reversed, as you noted, overruled, in order for you to reverse the decision that Judge Jameson made in St. Louis County. The next case that I believe you would have to reverse is the Batek case, Batek versus Curators of the University of Missouri. Because in Batek, it was decided by this court that medical malpractice claimants are not a protected class. And the argument made by plaintiffs here is that they are a protected class. just like the other very limited categories that we've recognized both in Missouri and in the federal system. Blaski, although it's not the statute of repose here, if you take plaintiff's argument as far as he wants to take it, they want to take it, really Blaski is even more problematic. The statute of repose there is even more problematic under their line of argument, yet it was upheld by this court. In fact, it was upheld on the same four grounds that are at issue here in this case. What do I mean by that? Well, in that case, you had more exceptions and more exclusions written into the statute of repose, yet the court here upheld it. Here, as counsel noted, there are fewer exceptions, yet there's even more reason to uphold it. That's my point. And again, it has been upheld in the Ross case. And in Baytech, it was determined medical malpractice claimants, such as the Phillips here, are not a protected class. I'd like to go quickly through the 4 points on appeal now. Covered the issue of real and substantial constitutional claim, the fact that it doesn't exist here. Open courts, I'd like to go there first, if you'll permit me. I'm going to cover this point first because it's a nice segue into the other points on appeal. All of which, again, the court doesn't even need to address because the preservational issue is there. An open courts violation requires plaintiffs to show, first of all, that there's a recognized cause of action. And I want to address this whole zero-time concept. That's not the way it works. You have a cause of action either when the damages are sustained or they're capable of ascertainment. There is no concept that the moment that those sponges allegedly were left in Mrs. Phillips' body, that time zero, she's damaged. No, that's not the case. And there have been other states that have looked at similar issues. The Avery versus State Farm case from the Illinois Supreme Court 2005 is a great example of how that court, and I think it's consistent with the thinking of this court, as well as our intermediate court of appeals, that we're not going to allow no damages cases.
I don't think you really want to argue that it's okay to leave things in people's bodies and they can't sue for it.
No, that's not my argument. My point is, and I think that Judge Tideman got to it, is just because something is, in this case, allegedly left in the body, that doesn't automatically mean that there are damages and you've accrued a cause of action and you therefore...
Is that your argument? Is that it's okay, I'm not damaged by your leaving foreign objects in my body?
Your Honor, first of all, it has to be...
Do you need to win that argument in order to win this?
My point is, Your Honor, that this concept of zero time, there being a cause of action that arises, that's not recognized by Missouri, that's not recognized by other states, that's a novel concept, that's my point. So to answer your question, no, I don't need to go there, but the notion that, in other words, it's sort of like, well, I don't even need a discovery rule. If there's something that happens, boom, I've got my cause of action, and now legislature, you can't take it away. I mean, that's the argument being made, and there are precedents from this court that say, no, that's not the case. And again, this court has declared as much in the Ross case. So there is no recognized cause of action. But even if you think there is the cause of action being restricted? Is it arbitrary or unreasonable? No. The legislature has extinguished it by virtue of enacting the statute of repose before Mrs. Phillips had the sponges allegedly left in her body. And also, when the plaintiffs cite these cases about violations, none of them involve what we have here. There's no condition precedent. For example, Cardinal Glennon was cited by counsel. There, a statute required a professional liability review board to get involved. In Strahler, you had, that's the St. Luke's case, you had a minor having to find an adult to pursue a case on his or her behalf, thereby making them dependent on the actions of others to assert their claims. Schumer, you had a statute requiring a 90-day notice before suing in a municipality, and then the Kilmer case with the dram shop situation where you had to have a liquor licensee convicted in a criminal prosecution. So we don't have any of those here. The only thing between Mrs. Phillips and being able to prosecute a claim, a cause of action, is the ability to discover it. That's the only thing that's standing before her, and that cause of action was extinguished by virtue of the statute of repose. Getting back to a question you raised, Judge Stith, yes, and I think counsel admitted it, basically what this is saying is we can't have statutes of repose in Missouri. We've got to throw them all out because there's something inherently unfair, and so we can't have statutes of repose. And I think counsel essentially admitted that. That's going a long way. You've got a lot of precedents now that have to be reversed.
Well, he's saying if it's already accrued, you can't have a statute of repose then.
If it's already accrued, yes. But the situation here is that it hadn't accrued. There was no cause of action because it was extinguished by virtue of the statute of repose before it ever could.
So if we find you could sue for lack of informed consent, for wrongful touching, for anything else prior to the time that you started having symptoms, then you lose?
That's not my argument, Your Honor. All I'm saying is that in order for plaintiffs to prevail here, statutes of repose would have to be declared facially unconstitutional. And I don't think that the court is prepared to do that. And in fact, it's said as much in previous decisions, particularly the Ross case. So the policy argument here comes down to that unlimited window of time. Judge Wilson, you asked the question, 30 years, 50 years, you didn't say 50, you said 30, but the bottom line is, yeah, that's basically what plaintiffs are asking for, is an unlimited window of time. Let's do away with all of our statutes of repose. I'd like to move now into special legislation and that point on appeal. You have to have injury. That's a required element for any plaintiff to allege medical negligence. And our legislature has not erected a barrier there between the plaintiffs and the courts. You don't have a special law because we're including everyone. The Ross decision from this court said foreign object, no foreign object, we're treating everybody in the state the same way. So that's already been decided. This court's already addressed that issue. There is no local or special law. That's right out of Ross. So we don't have special legislation. And to the extent that you have to do an equal protection type analysis, I'll get to that next. That's what I'm covering now, largely for the same reasons that I just mentioned regarding special legislation and open courts. We don't have a problem with equal protection as well. And this court in Baytech said as much, that medical malpractice plaintiffs are not a specially protected class. And that's another decision that would have to be overruled if you agree with, if you want to rule for the plaintiffs and reverse in this situation. As we know, suspect or specially protected classes are those that have to be protected from invidious discrimination. You apply strict scrutiny only in situations of race, national origin, illegitimacy. Nowhere near that here. Fundamental rights have to be involved, rights to speech, vote, interstate travel. Don't have that here. You don't have any suspect classes or fundamental rights involved, so we're not in strict scrutiny territory. Intermediate, we don't have gender discrimination. We don't have some of the other sex-based classifications involved. And so we're not in the area of intermediate scrutiny either. We drop down to rational basis tests. And here's where this court and any court in Missouri has actually what I call a discovery rule. It is required to discover a reason why the legislature had a rational basis for passing the law, and that is out of the Winston case, okay, a decision from this court. There are rational bases, many of them, and it's not the duty of any court in Missouri to question those so long as they're rationally related. Here, reasons would include, among others, the fact that you have unique challenges encountered by the professionals that treat either foreign object or that are conducting surgery. You have the decision by the legislature that, hey, at some point, we have to let these professionals, disassociate them from a particular engagement, disassociate them from the surgery. Here, after 10 years...
So the unique challenges on sponges would be, well, we started off with 10 sponges, and we ended up with 9. That's a unique challenge to count to 10? I mean...
Well,
they're supposed to have someone there who counts up the stuff you put in to make sure you're not leaving anything behind.
The legislature has the ability and I would argue the right to set a limit at some point. And here it's 10 years. And I would note to the court, Your Honor, that there are
I was just referring to unique challenges in the
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I was referring to your unique challenges as a professional. You mentioned unique challenges.
Your point is, I understand your point, Your Honor. It's a matter of counting sponges being off by one. I understand your point there. But, and that's looking at the micro level, I completely understand. But at the macro level, we have to have a limit somewhere. At least in Missouri so far, that's something that we recognize. And 10 years was the limit. And what I wanted to point out was there are many states, and we cite the states in our brief, where it's much less than 10 years. It's as little as 3 years in some cases, statutes of repose. And so Missouri actually has extended a time period that is much longer than you see in a lot of states. And some of these states, by the way, are like Oregon, Wisconsin, states where you might be surprised on first glance to see.
Any states with longer points of repose, 15 years, 20 years?
Based on the research that Ms. Parrish and I did, Your Honor, I didn't find one that was longer than 10 years. I'm not saying that one doesn't exist, but at least, you know, looking through my notes right now, I'm not aware of one that's longer than 10 years. But I would answer the question this way, that the great majority of states are well within 10 years. I can say that with certainty. Whether there might be one, an outlier that's above 10 is possible, I can't say with certainty, though.
Can I back you up to the preservation question? Did you say there was a case that we had decided on this statute? Or, you know, because BATEC the other were on similar statutes?
Yes, Your Honor. There is one, and that's the Ross case. Ross versus Kansas City General Hospital and Medical Center, 608 Southwest 2nd, 397.
And was that an open courts challenge or just a due process and equal protection challenge?
That was more of an equal protection challenge, Your Honor. But I believe that in that sense, the special legislation would be equally applicable because you do essentially an equal protection analysis you engage in an analysis which is akin to an equal protection analysis, I think, in that. So, yes, Ross was the case where this court held the statute of repose was constitutional and applied equally and uniformly throughout the state. So under rational basis review, this legislature had reasons. Now, we can disagree, we can agree with those reasons, but we're not in an area where it's Judge Jameson's role or any other court's role to second-guess those so long as they're rationally related, and I think we have that here. So finally, there's the substantive due process. And here's where the constitutionality of the law really, I think, becomes clear. You know, the first case that we had this morning is a great contrast in terms of what kind of rights are being dealt with here. We're not dealing with rights of marriage or the right to divorce. We're dealing with something that doesn't fall within something that either the U.S. Supreme Court or this court, or to my knowledge, any court, at least certainly not the great majority of courts in the high courts of the states of our land, have ever said, this, we're going to elevate this now to the same area that we've found these other fundamental substantive due process rights. So, bottom line, there are lots of policy arguments as well why the court should
hold. In what circumstances have statutes of repose been found unconstitutional?
I have to add, Your Honor, I saw that a great majority of states had found it constitutional. I have to admit I did not focus on those that didn't. I'm not saying that there are not some states that haven't gone the other way. They probably are. But honestly, I
get it. That's fine.
You're being honest.
I don't know. I guess is what I should say there. Sorry. So I can say this, though. 19 states and one territory do have statutes of repose that apply equally to foreign body cases. I can give you that statistic. 19 states and one territory have statutes that have a similar statute to ours, and they've upheld it. Going outside of that, I can't give you
further.
But I'd ask that you affirm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Now, address the procedural issue that the first, if you could.
The procedural issue.
Preserving
issue.
Which of your constitutional arguments that you're making, Des, did you make to the trial court?
All of them. And this
and what's the easiest place in the record to find where you made all those?
It would be the response to the plaintiff's motion to dismiss. I think that's what it was called, or the summary judgment. Somebody raised an interesting question about the 10 years. There's nothing magical about the 10 years, and by virtue of that, it's arbitrary. So then the issue becomes: is it unreasonable? And
have there any states been that reversed it? Have any states reversed the 10-year repose?
Held invalid.
10 years specifically? I don't know.
Have any states invalidated a statute of repose?
Ohio has. Ohio did that 20 plus years ago. And the site escapes me, that's in the briefing.
Do they have a statute of repose now in Ohio?
They do have a statute of repose now in Ohio, and there was a subsequent decision. I don't know. I think Mr. Sandstone's right, or approximately right, about there being about 19 states. Some of them apply only to foreign objects. Some of them apply generally. There are some states that have...
The last count I had, there were 50 states.
There are 50 states, but not every state has a statute of repose.
Pardon me?
There are 50 states, but not every state has a statute of repose, okay, specifically for malpractice. There are probably a dozen or so states that have a general statute of repose.
Is there any state that just in general has said a statute of repose is unconstitutional, the concept of having one?
Not for my
It's a, in a particular instance they would have addressed
it's
it,
a particular
as far as your
As far as I know, there could be, but again, kind of segueing into the special legislation, because this is special to malpractice cases, and it doesn't apply to every malpractice case. I do a lot of malpractice work, and the run-of-the-mill case, 2 years. You either meet it or you don't. In this case, if you have a foreign object, it's told. Coincidentally today, this afternoon, I have a mediation in a negligent failure to inform. That's another exception. So this 10-year repose would never apply to the general statute of limitations. And something...
But doesn't that hurt your argument? If we find the statute of repose is special, wouldn't we find the discovery rule that's specially permitted for foreign objects and failure to inform also special?
No, because there are distinctions within the discovery rule. It treats foreign object litigants or claimants differently.
I know. Is that special, too?
Absolutely. I mean, for instance, for a minor, a minor has until they're 20 to bring a malpractice case. Say there was a foreign object left in them when they were 8. They discovered it within 10 years, but they still get to bring it outside of 10 years. I didn't concentrate on how the fraudulent concealment would play into this. Does that toll it out? I mean, there are a variety of scenarios where foreign objects is left.
So if you're 5 years old, you had a foreign objects in you, and you reached the age of majority, then you have an extra 10 years?
You would have 2 years from the date you reached the age of majority, but that means if they're 5 years old, they have 15 years, which is different from the Phillipses. She was not a minor. She under the statute, it's only given 10 years. It's unreasonable. There are barriers, and for those reasons, I'd ask the Constitution. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That'll be taken under submission.